you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello, friends. Good to see you again, and welcome back to a special edition of the Bill Press Pod, coming to you all the way from Rome, Italy, where I'm spending the month of April as a visiting scholar at the wonderful American Academy of Rome. For myself and millions of Americans, what we know about Italy and Western Europe is thanks to the great reporting of NPR's legendary Silvia Pajoli, the senior European correspondent on NPR's international desk. I gotta tell you, you can't come to Rome without checking in with Silvia Pajoli. And that's especially important today with the war in Ukraine, the recent election in Hungary, and the runoff in France dominating the headlines. So we were lucky to catch up with Silvia Pajoli here in Rome to get the lay of the land in Europe and how it impacts the United States. Silvia Pajoli, it's an honor to have you join the Bill Press Pod. Thank you so much. And what great fun to join you in the eternal city of Rome.
Well, it's a pleasure to join you, Bill, here in Rome.
Well, thanks so much. So your beat for a long time has been Italy and the Vatican and Western Europe. I'd like to ask you about all three, but let's start with Western Europe. I mean, it's had its ups and downs recently, but how do you judge the state of the European Union or Western Europe today? Are they, these countries, united? Are they strong? How do you read it?
Well, I think the Russian invasion of Ukraine has had the unexpected result of being the most unifying factor in the European Union, at least in many years. I think certainly to the dismay of Vladimir Putin, who has made no secret of his desire to create disunity and division among the Europeans, as well as between, of course, the United States and its European allies. So I think there's been an extraordinary meeting of minds among European leaders, with to some extent the exception a little bit of Hungary, which has been hot and cold in some of its official decisions towards, it's an ally. It's been generally an ally of Vladimir Putin, but it has also taken some, it's been up and down. But with that exception, there's been extraordinary. And of course, it was extremely important, the German decision to, first of all, cut off or suspend at least the Nord Stream pipeline to Russia.
Right.
That was totally unexpected. Germany is the most dependent on Russian oil. And that, I think, really galvanized also the other Europeans, saying if Germany can do it, we can too. Just yesterday, there was, I believe, yesterday, a Financial Times piece that showed how much the Italian Prime Minister, Mario Draghi, the former head of the European Central Bank, was instrumental in getting also the United States and all the Europeans together to actually do sanctions on the Russian Central Bank, which has also been a key element in the sanctions program. So I'd say, there's a lot of unity right now. It'll be tested very much in coming months because of the oil issue, the issue of dependency on oil. The Europeans, mainly Germany and Italy at this point, do not feel they can absolutely immediately do sanctions against all oil and gas imports. They're too dependent on Russian oil and gas. But for the moment, extraordinary unity, I'd say.
And what role has the United States or President Biden played in that? Obviously, a lot of awkward moments under Donald Trump, Joe Biden taking a very different approach. Has that been a positive influence?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you said it. I mean, relations with Trump, at least among the West Europeans, was disastrous, and Biden's election was hailed as he put it, "America is back." There was very, very good feeling at the last at the first G7 meetings, and certainly since the Ukraine invasion. No, it's been very good. There's, I think, for the moment, as I said, a great working together, both on NATO, EU relations, the United States, a lot of common ground there.
And if there is one outlier, and you mentioned Hungary, here the authoritarian leader and Putin ally, Viktor Orban, just reelected to a fourth term. Is he the outlier, or is there a fear that what happened in Hungary could be have a ripple effect to other countries?
Well, you know, up until, again, the invasion of Ukraine, there was a kind of Eastern Front, which was mainly Poland, Hungary, and the smaller country, Slovenia, to the south, but all run by very, very right-wing conservative governments. For the moment, again, there's been a tremendous reversal in Poland, which has shown itself incredibly open to welcoming Ukrainian refugees, siding with Ukraine, and basically almost breaking certainly this sort of informal sort of alliance with Hungary. Again, how long will that last? Not clear, because until the Ukraine invasion, the traditional old-time partners, the Western Europeans, were very, very worried about what was called the sort of Visegrad Pact, this East European, Hungary, Poland, Slovakia to some extent, Czech Republic, and most in Slovenia, the right-wing portions of Eastern Europe. It's weaker now because of Poland's being on totally taking Ukraine, pro-Ukraine position.
So you mentioned refugees. What has been the role? We've seen, as you mentioned, Poland for sure taking so many hundreds of thousands of refugees. How about Italy? Has Italy and other countries reached out in Western Europe to accept refugees from Ukraine?
Oh, very much so. And of course, there's been a certain amount of criticism saying, you know, many of these countries were totally opposed to migrants when they were coming from,
of course,
from Africa or from the Middle East, non-Europeans, Africans, Middle Easterns, Southeast Asians. And now all of a sudden, all these open arms for those who look like us, quote unquote. So, yes, there's been, but no, there's been threat. Now, the case of Italy, which I know better, first of all, there were already a lot of Ukrainians here. Many of them were healthcare workers. They're caretakers for the elderly. So many Ukrainians who were fleeing the Russians, the invasion, now had family here, and they have rejoined. The numbers, of course, are much smaller than those in Poland. It's also much further away, but there are several hundred thousand. And now, again, will this welcoming openness be, will it continue for months to come when the numbers may increase by the hundreds of thousands? Again, that's probably one of Putin's strategy is just, you know, create a disturbance in the Europeans by creating a refugee crisis, which was also the playbook the Belarusians used a few months ago against Poland, opening up their borders and pushing all these migrants into Poland. So will this benevolent attitude toward Ukrainian refugees last many months ahead? I don't know. But for the moment, there's been a tremendous outpouring of help and assistance. I mean, everywhere I go, I see, you know, help the Ukrainians. There are people raising food caravans going there. A lot of help, a lot of assistance, a lot of benevolent attitude towards the situation there.
Now, so I've been in Rome now for a couple of weeks, and everybody I've talked to, from taxi drivers on, have good things to say about Mario Draghi, the prime minister. That's kind of unusual for Italy, isn't it?
Well, you know, he's an extraordinary. I mean, he is a very, he's a notch ahead, atop of all their politicians. He has an excellent international reputation. He famously saved the euro during the euro crisis with his great line, the ECB, the European Central Bank, will do whatever it takes to save the euro. And he did, basically printing money. But anyways, it helped. And he has He has a great, great prestige. And so even though he was not, it's a complicated situation how he came to power. He was not elected. He's not a politician. The parties have all been sort of bickering and fighting. And the chief of state, who basically the Italian president, can intervene when he appointed Mario Draghi as prime minister of what could be called a broad national coalition government. It's a very odd situation. It goes from left to right with only one extreme right-wing party on the opposition. So, and they're still bickering. I mean, it's not easy. I mean, they can't all, but nobody right now wants early elections, or at least none of the majority of the parties don't want early mm-hmm. elections. And it would be a very difficult situation now with the situation in Ukraine. So, Draghi, and you know, he was the person who was put in charge, basically, of putting into effect the large amount of money Italy was going to get from the European Union post-COVID. A lot of assistance. Mm. Italy mm-hmm. was one of the first countries hit by the COVID crisis. The economy has suffered tremendously. It succeeded in getting pledges of large sums of money from the European Union. And Draghi will be the one in charge of basically distributing and seeing how that those big funds are employed in a country that is notorious for its corruption and organized crime. So that's to be seen what happens.
I'm pretty sure you have not been on the ground covering the war in Ukraine, correct?
No, absolutely. No, I have
but
not.
But you did, of course, were there in the war in the Balkans. Some 20 years ago now?
Now it's 30, I guess.
30, yeah. What difference do you see watching the coverage, particularly several journalists have been killed, it's been very dangerous for journalists, but it was also in the war in the Balkans, wasn't it? Tell us about your experience and how you compare it to what people are doing today.
Well, the very first big difference for journalists, certainly, is that we did not have social media mm-hmm. at that time. And we did not even, certainly in the Bosnian War, which went from, let's say the first war started in 91 in Croatia, and then the Bosnian War went from 92 to 95. Throughout that period, there were no cell phones. So, and satellite phones were still hugely big and cumbersome, and so we're not something you could carry around. By the time the Kosovo War started in 99, we had the first sort of cell phones we're working, but you know, there was no Wi-Fi. So filing meant that you had to get to a landline either at your hotel or in somebody's home. So you couldn't do this 24-hour coverage as easily as now. And there wasn't social media, but that doesn't, but otherwise there are an awful lot of similarities. First of all, many, many journalists were killed, they were actually purposefully targeted in the Balkan Wars by all sides, but mainly by the Serbs and the Croats. There were three sides in the Balkan Wars, at least. And then there was the Kosovo War. That's another one. But and then the other thing is there was just as much disinformation and manipulation of news through the various media outlets of the warring parties. And so that was also something, you know, difficult. Fact-checking was really a challenge of all the sometimes battles would be announced, slaughters here, slaughters there, and then you found out that they didn't exist, or there were ones that you didn't know about. So that was the similarity. The other similarity, of course, is at the actual war, it's ethnic cleansing. I mean, that's what we first heard about it, most of us in modern mm-hmm. times, in the Balkan Wars. And it's pretty much exactly what we see the Russians are doing. It was theorized in the Balkans that even during the Second World War, there was a Croatian of the sort of pro-Nazi Ustasha state. At the time, he said, one third of Serbs we shall kill, another we shall deport, and the last we shall force to embrace the Roman Catholic religion. So that they can meld with the Croats. Now, maybe the last is not exactly in the Russian playbook, but certainly deporting and killing and expelling from their homes is pretty much the same playbook as I saw in the Balkans. It's really quite shocking, and also the sieges. Yesterday on television, I saw scenes of a small town that the Russians had left from, and there were these people coming out of their cellars after a month, and I saw the same. It was like an echo of what I heard in the city of Mostar in Croatia, where the Muslim population was spent 10 months. 60,000 Muslims spent 10 months in their cellars under siege from the Croats. And I was there when they came out, and I remember this. And the echo of the language, of the thing, the experience, it's so similar. It's very, very disturbing, really.
Now, when I hear Putin's talk about Greater Russia, it reminds me of, because I was there to cover the war in Croatia, it reminds me of Milosevic's chant about Greater Serbia.
Exactly. Yeah. The other thing is this grievances, this constant looking back in history and this manipulation and distortion of the events of the past to justify the actions of today. This is the same playbook, too.
Right. So, Jolie, enough for Western Europe. I want to talk about the Vatican. I'm a mile away as we're speaking right now. But let's take a quick break first here on the Bill Press Spot, and then we'll come back and pick up on the other side. Friends, you know, I'm like you, I'm sure. Every time we see the images of Ukraine on television, people being blown out of their apartment buildings, taking shelter in basements, fleeing to the borders, families breaking up, all of us ask ourselves, oh my God, what can we do? How can we possibly help? Here's another idea. Carol and I are doing this, and I hope you will too. Let's help out the World Central Kitchen. Jose Andres and his people are on the scene like they are with every major disaster. They're on the job in Ukraine, in Poland, Moldova, in Romania, helping the refugees, providing hot meals, and a whole lot more. They need our help. And that's one way to get help directly to the Ukrainian people. Go to their website at WCK.org and provide whatever help you can. Thank you.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back with a very special guest today, senior European correspondent for NPR's international desk for a long time. You know her, you hear her voice, you hear her reports from Europe and Italy, Sylvia and the Vatican, Sylvia Poggioli. Sylvia, again, so welcome back. A lot of people don't realize, but certainly you do, when you walk into the Vatican, you're actually leaving Italy and walking into another whole country, right? With its own rules, its own customs, and its own way of doing things.
That's true. Absolutely. Well, it's called the city state, the Vatican City State, and it has an observer status at the United Nations, and it does not have its own currency, but it has its own stamps, and Vatican City employees, residents have their own passport.
So how many popes have you covered?
And now Pope Francis.
And how accessible are they to reporters?
Not at all.
Because, I mean, we complain all the time at the White House, right? The presence, not accessible enough. I wonder, it's even more difficult, right, to get a question to the Pope.
No, the one time, and it was started, I believe, by John Paul II. It's now under Francis. When he does international trips, the Vatican correspondents accredited to follow him on the travel with him on the plane. On the return, he always gives a press conference. That's the one time when reporters. That's one of the sort of thrills about getting on a papal flight, is because you get to really, you know, we get to ask him questions.
Does he walk down the aisle and just stand in the aisle?
He comes into the economy section where we are, and he's at the front, and he has a mm-hmm. microphone. And those of us who are radio and TV, we are already wired, and we can record everything he says. And generally, among the group of reporters are sort of divided into language groups: English, Italian, French, mm-hmm. German, and Spanish. And each sort of language group presents a few questions, let's say. Uh-huh. So we have it's not one of these screaming, yelling, try to get over, you know, it's all much more. The big fights are among the reporters about which questions to ask, because we know we have a limited time and so. But he has amazing stamina. I mean, this man is 85 years old. He's got problem. He's got sciatica, and he has a trick knee. But he generally stands there for even more than an hour with his microphone and takes questions in Italian mostly, and sometimes and in his native Spanish.
Does he ever make news?
Often does. I think the very first trip he took was probably the biggest news he made, was when he was on his return flight. I think it was just a few months after he was elected, on his return flight from Brazil. He was asked about gays, and he said, "Who am I to judge if a person believes in God and who am I to judge? If someone is gay and searches for the Lord and has goodwill, who am I to judge?" That was a pretty revolutionary statement when his predecessor, Benedict, as when he was still cardinal and the Vatican enforcer of doctrine, he had declared that homosexuality was not a sin, but an objective disorder with a strong tendency towards intrinsic moral evil. So I'd say that was a pretty dramatic switch, and it definitely made news. Yeah.
What's his next trip? He likes to travel, doesn't he? He's done a lot of international travel.
Well, we understand that as cardinal, he did not travel much. He was not a big traveler, but what he likes, and he has said it many times, is he likes to go to the peripheries of the world. He goes where there are small Catholic communities that maybe feel that they've been forgotten. One of the most memorable trips was just a little over a year ago. I was on it when we went to Iraq, and he went to northern Iraq to visit these small Christian communities that had been devastated by ISIS, really horrible persecution and murders and slaughter. And these are some of the oldest Christian communities in the world. They're there. They date from the time of the apostles. And that's a sign, you know, when he goes to these parts, he's gone to countries that have very small Christian populations, but where there are still Christian communities, and this is a signal. He's gone to, for example, to very few European countries, which one would expect, which are predominantly Christian or Catholic.
What's the next trip, and have you signed up?
We don't. Oh, yeah, there is a next trip, but we haven't been asked to sign up yet. Oh. He's going in July, right in the middle of summer, to South Sudan and Congo.
Wow.
And that's going to be a very
interesting trip. You would not think of that as a place a Catholic Pope would go, right?
No, but he's been very much involved in the peace process. He invited last year the Sudanese leaders to the Vatican. He even got down on the floor and kissed their feet. You can imagine that was quite extraordinary. So wherever there's been strife and war and divisions, he tries to go. The big one would be, we've been asking, would he go to Ukraine? And you asked, does he make news? Just the other day, returning from Malta, he said they're thinking about a possibility of a visit to Kyiv. But most of us think that that's pretty difficult at this point. I don't know if that could come off right now.
Very difficult. You mentioned John Paul II. I've seen so many shrines, if you will, to John Paul II in Rome. His funeral was a moment that you covered extensively for NPR. There's never been one like that in modern times, has there?
Not to my knowledge, absolutely not. I remember there was talk that 3 million people came to Rome over a period of about 3 or 4 days after he died, and they were all lined up in St. Peter's Square and in the long avenue, Via della Conciliazione, that leads from the River Tiber up to St. Peter's Square. It was one of them. I've never seen anything like that in my life. They came mostly from Europe, from Poland, of course, but from all over. And it was really, it was extraordinary.
And he was, he's now a saint, has been canonized a saint by the Roman Catholic Church. That happened pretty fast. Isn't that sort of a historic record too?
Yes. In fact, already during the funeral, there were these chants of many constant chants, Santo subito, make him a saint immediately. And his successor, Pope Benedict, formerly Joseph Ratzinger, who had been the theological watchdog under John Paul II, did exactly that. He beatified and had him canonized very quickly. I think it was a record time.
He sort of rushed him through the way Mitch McConnell rushed Amy Coney Barrett through the Supreme Court. I couldn't help but think of that. So, Sylvia, how long have you, let's talk a little bit about Sylvia Poggioli. How long have you been at NPR now?
This year marks 40 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Whoa. Congratulations. How'd you get started? In Europe, in Italy, or?
Well, actually, it's funny. I had, after college, I came to Rome on a Fulbright scholarship after college, and NPR did not exist when I left. And I went back to the States for a year in the early 80s. My husband had a fellowship. He was a journalist. He had a fellowship there. And one of his co-fellows was an NPR reporter named Margot Adler, who was a fantastic person. And I got to know NPR through her, and we became very good friends. And so when I went back to Rome, I asked if they needed somebody to be a stringer, and they didn't have anybody. So I started, and that's how I started working for the NPR. I started stringing from Rome, and then started traveling.
And they say, and the rest is history, as they say. What's a biggest story that you remember that you was the most exciting for you, or one or two?
Oh, that's hard. Well, the biggest certainly probably were in the were the Balkan. I mean, 10 years of covering the demise of Yugoslavia, the collapse of Yugoslavia was certainly the biggest thing probably. I covered. I think what I did also, one of the things I was very proud of was very early on, I did a lot of series in parts of Western Europe on the whole issue of migration, long before people were talking about these great influxes of migration, but the issue about, large Muslim populations in France, in Britain, in Germany, and how difficult it was for these nation states, these sort of that were born as monoethnic societies, the whole idea of trying to understand and the difficult, and which is at the basis of a lot of all these right-wing anti-immigration movements now that are seeping through parts of Europe. And it was very interesting. I got to know a lot about the issues in the issue in France with many from the immigrants from the Maghreb, the whole dilemmas and national debates over these issues, which are now have been overwhelmed by the influx of migrants from you know, coming from Africa and from from Southeast Asia. But I started doing that in the late 90s, and I think that was one of the most important stories that I've covered.
And recently, it seems there's been a export of Trumpism to Western Europe, or to certainly Eastern Europe. But what I hear you're saying, it didn't start with Trump, but it found some roots here in Europe that people identified with, right? Particularly the anti-immigration part of it.
There was a moment in Italy 2-3 years ago when one of these right-wing parties, or I should say two sort of right-wing parties, gained a lot and formed a government together. Well, the sort of a maverick five-star movement, and then the very, very right-wing League Party, very anti-immigrant. And that was, it was a very bad time. That was like 2018, 2019. Mm-hmm. But I think their popularity has declined a lot. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's not over. But everybody now, what will everybody be watching is what happens in France. There's going to be elections, and the polls show it's going to be a tight race between Macron and Marine Le Pen. If she wins, that'll change everything.
So one other note about NPR, which I was surprised to find when I did a little Googling of Sylvia Poggioli, is you were a frequent guest on Car Talk, of all programs. I mean, how did that get started? I mean, what? I didn't see you as a natural guest with click and clack.
Yeah, no, I was not a guest. I was a constant, from what I understand, a topic of conversation.
Oh, okay.
That they use. No, you know, it's so funny because Click and Clack, the Magliacci brothers, are also from my hometown, which is Cambridge, Massachusetts. I think we had a feeling. No, they were wonderful guys. They were terrific. And their show was wonderful show. And I have a very, very fond memory of them. And Carta.
Well, it was certainly my favorite program on NPR, I must admit. I did see at some little ad that you did for the program where you called it my favorite program yourself. Yeah, so right. they were great, and I'm sure that they certainly saw Sylvia Poggioli, right, as a partner, right?
Italian American.
From Cambridge. No, they were great. Sylvia, it's been so great talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Bill Press Pod. I just have one favor to ask you. Can you tell us goodbye the way you normally say goodbye on NPR?
Sure. First of all, thank you for having me. It was great fun. And this is Sylvia Poggioli in Rome.
Thank you, Sylvia. Talk to you again soon.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And that's it from Rome with Sylvia Poggioli. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, we'll be back on Thursday this week with a roundtable from Washington. Then I'll be back next Tuesday from Rome with an exclusive interview with Ambassador Cindy McCain, who now serves in the extremely important post of America's ambassador to the United Nations agencies for food and agriculture. It has a lot to do with feeding the refugees coming from Ukraine. Until then, take care of yourself, and from Rome, arrivederci. Ciao.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.